Hello and welcome to On Integrity. My name is Ella and I'm a third year biological natural science student.
And my name is Temi and I'm a third year psychological and behavioural science student, and you're listening on CAM FM.
If you haven't already, feel free to go back and check out number one and two. But yeah, we're here with number three. And what are we talking about today, Temi?
We are going to be talking about famous black scientists that have done important things but have been excluded, forgotten or censored throughout time.
Because think about like your curriculum. Let me just see. Name three black scientists right now.
Me, you.
No, not you. Like, we've already talked about it, but all I'm saying is, and like, not to make you feel like guilty, it's like literally not in our curriculum, you know. And I think, yeah, we're going to address some of the reasons why we think personally this kind of takes place. Mm-hmm. And then try and bring some of the scientists that have been hidden or have had their work stolen and not be given the correct recognition and talk about them.
Yeah.
So I'm excited for that.
I'm excited. There's some really interesting people I think we're going to talk about today that you guys, hopefully, will enjoy.
And some psychologists, right, Temi?
Yes! Finally!
We must have talked about psychology at some point, right? Maybe not.
Like last week's episode, we spoke briefly about like psychological effects, but it's nice to give psychology a little bit of a firm standing, you know, a little
Definitely.
Bit of a place.
All about uplifting, you know.
Thank you.
I think we should just read the paragraph. Read the paragraph. We've talked too long already.
Okay, thank you. Okay, here we go. While parts of history are selectively removed from science education, black scientists and their contributions are ignored too. I doubt many of us are aware of George Washington Carver. George was born into slavery in Diamond, Missouri in the early 1860s. Despite many severe setbacks in his education, including being turned away from his closest school and later the first university he was accepted into for the colour of his skin, George did go on to attend university at Iowa State, complete his master's, and head the agricultural department at the Tuskegee Institute. His work contributed significantly to agricultural development, for example, in the rollout of alternative cash crops for farmers with nutrient-depleted soils due to previous cotton farming, and the use for these new crops, most famously for peanuts. He set up a mobile classroom to bring this information to farmers. His research involved the quality of life for farming families, and he became an icon for black and white Americans alike. But his face is nowhere to be seen in the curriculum.
Mm-mm, it's not. Did you know about him?
Not anywhere. I didn't.
And Temi. Oh. because this guy, right, was so significant in his work at the time. Like, and one, right, so he's had these amazing accomplishments in science, and two,
exactly.
The setbacks he had to go through to get to that stage where he was, like, practically number one at the time were incredible. And I think it's just when you understand the context of what someone's gone through and the setbacks they have had and what makes it so much more difficult than, like, a white or a rich counterpart at the time.
Exactly.
You have to just value it so much more. And that's definitely something we need to take into today, because obviously there's a whole, I don't know if it's a debate or, because in my mind it's not really a debate, but in some people it probably
a discussion is. Let's say
discussion about like whether positive discrimination or like access schemes or mentoring and things like that are a good idea for people from underrepresented backgrounds. But if we look into the past and we see these people that have had to go through so much and then still make it on top, imagine all the other people that if they had been lucky in that way to get those opportunities,
exactly,
what successes would come from that as well.
Honestly. Because it's like, for me, I like personally gained from using schemes like that. Mm-hmm. Like East London, if you didn't know, I'm a black woman.
They do now.
and I had mentor schemes. I had charities that would work with me and other universities to aid people like me to get to institutions like Cambridge or Russell Group Unis or unis in general. Like, just being able to go to university is a proud and momentous thing for me. And I feel like I'm happy we're using discussion, because I don't really think it's a debate, because until people can go to university without having that kind of barrier or having to work a little bit harder than other people your age, like your age mates, I think it's needed, and I think there needs to be more of it.
Same.
But that is for later episodes, actually. So
yeah, that is actually, I've clocked, we've already gone off topic, but anyway, like, just linking it back, like, obviously we're not saying that, as we'll go on to, as we said, you know, George was born into slavery. That's obviously a very different struggle. Well, not necessarily for different parts of the world, but we're not saying that his struggle coming from slavery and becoming a scientist is equivalent to, you know, anyone else who's struggling in a different way today.
Yeah.
But recognising that, you know, where someone comes from has a profound influence on, well, it shouldn't, but it does, you know what I mean? Like,
exactly.
It does have an influence on how easy it is to break out of it. And yeah, that's basically the word privilege, right? Like,
definitely.
And recognizing that there's been people in the past that have come from difficult places and setbacks, and recognizing that there are reflections to today in terms of people doing amazing things in those places, but then thinking, exactly. Well, how are we going to solve this? It's not fair that people have to go through this kind of struggle.
Yeah.
And you can do that through those type of schemes and things like that. But yeah, that's definitely like the solutions episode that we want to talk about later on.
Yes. So I think the best place for us to start is just to talk a little bit more about George Washington Carver and his journey and all the amazing work he ended up doing despite his major setbacks in life. Like, I can't even imagine doing majority and living through majority of what he went through. And it just, oh, I'm just so proud of him. Mm. Just, oh, I'm warm. Because just amazing things, honestly.
But despite doing that, we don't give him the recognition today that he deserves. Like, despite coming for all of that, oh, it makes me mad. But hopefully today we're going to tell a few more people about what he did.
Exactly. Let's take a look into his childhood and the situation he was born into and what kind of set him up for the way he had to navigate his life. So he was born into slavery in Diamond Grove, Missouri. His birthday is not known, but it was definitely before the abolishment of slavery in January 1865.
But yeah, it was kind of around that time, basically. So, yeah. Like, slaves, they didn't know their birthday always. But because he was, as a very young child, slavery was abolished, that's why we can kind of infer that he was born just before it. And his master was Moses Carver, which is where, obviously, he gets his surname. That's how that kind of thing works, is that I think he has a story about when he was a young boy and a woman asked what his name was, and he just said he's Carver's George, because he'd always addressed himself as being owned by this man, Moses Carver. So he's like, I'm Carver's George. And she was like, not anymore, you're George Carver. Like, she, you know, so that's basically the whole, like, yeah, I know, right? Like, the whole idea of where the surnames came from at the time. So yeah, after slavery was abolished, Carver himself actually raised George as a young child, and him and his wife taught him how to read and write. And again, this kind of shows, like, not everyone would have had that chance at the time.
Exactly. And
even though he's got all his own setbacks in a way of, you know, initially being born to slavery and then later his schooling, as we'll talk about, he had an opportunity there to learn to read and write, which many other kids at that same time wouldn't have had.
But the thing is, yeah, for me, it's like, I can't congratulate them for teaching him how to read and write. Like,
not in the slightest.
Like,
I'm not
bare
I'm not
minimum
praising them in the slightest.
Oh, it's like, okay, yeah, I'm happy he got that opportunity, but also, what are you doing? Like,
yeah, slave owners.
Yeah,
like, literally. We won't be praising them
ever.
So yeah, in Diamond Grove, where he grew up, he wasn't actually allowed to go to the nearest public school because of the colour of his skin. They didn't allow black children to study there. So he actually had to end up going to a school 16 kilometres south. That in itself is another example of the setbacks he had to go through. He would have had, you know, like, it goes without saying, right? Like, going to school much further away is just so much harder than going to the nearest school, and then likely still enduring racism at the other school and things like that. So
exactly,
yeah.
It's just, why should he have to just go to those extreme lengths just to receive education? Like, for me, education is fundamental in whatever source it comes from. It doesn't have to be strict academic education, just one form of stimulating your mind and educating yourself in one way or another. And I feel like it's just so upsetting that that privilege isn't given to him, you know.
Like, and it's also saying, like, even though slavery was abolished, like, some people might say, well, there's no slavery anymore, like, what is the setback that he's experiencing? There was obviously still, like, profound, like, systemic racism of the time, like, overt racism of the time, which there still is today, but you know what I mean? Like, even though it kind of brings up the point that even though maybe it could be argued that certain systems aren't in place, there's definitely still setbacks for people of colour in reflections today. Again, not directly comparing what he had to go through to what people have to go through today, but it's definitely something that we should be considering. So yeah, he did end up going through education, and he applied to lots of different universities after that.
Great.
And he was actually accepted into Highland University in Kansas, and it was all good. And on his first day, he got there, and they didn't let him in because of the colour of his skin. He went through every part of the admissions process, and yeah, imagine, I think, not also just being really, really annoying, like, but the kind of deflation you must feel as well, like, I just can't even imagine. It's disgusting, because, isn't it?
Do you know what I, like, okay, this word, I think there has to be some sort of internal evil, because you already know that you're not going to, because I'm assuming the process was, like, multi-step, right? Like, I'm just assuming. So why let him go through all of that just to be like, oh, well, you're a great candidate?
I don't think they knew that, like, he was black. Like, I think that's the whole thing, that they didn't know until he turned up, right? Yeah. So everything was right.
Yeah.
Apart from...
racism just baffles me. Like, clearly a candidate that you think is great to really push education forward, and you decide, got too much melanin in there for me. Like, come on now, you can do better than that.
Yeah, and it's like, it shows that, so as we'll find out, obviously George didn't go on to stop after this point, but imagine how many other young black intelligent academics got to a stage where they wanted to continue with it, and then were just told at one point, no, you're not allowed
exactly.
in. And I would completely understand if someone didn't want to continue with that. Like, I understand today
exactly.
why people don't want to be a scientist, because they don't see anyone like
exactly.
them. If someone told me I wasn't allowed to go somewhere because of race or something, then that would just, I can completely understand if you don't want to go into it. Because, you know, you can push and you can be an advocate for things and you can be an inspiration or whatever, but that in itself, and again, we'll talk about that in the next episode, it's tiring as a young person, as an old person, as whatever. So especially when there are going to be areas where you're accepted for who you are, why would you want to always be against the tide?
Honestly,
because that's not your role in this life as well. So I'm just saying that we think about why we don't see as many people from underrepresented ethnic backgrounds historically in science. Well, it's likely that they were either went through so many setbacks that they were, because of the color of their skin, they weren't allowed to get to a point
exactly
which they could be recognized at the same level, or they did and then were rejected for that reason, and rightly so, didn't want to continue with
exactly.
that.
I just feel like it just requires so much resilience and strength, and as you said, our job in this life is not constantly to be strong and resilient and fighting and fighting and fighting all the time. That's why just the respect goes to people who did push through and did make amazing, life-changing things for to allow people like us to have people to look up to, you know? This respect levels
definitely
just way up there, because it requires strength that some days I'm just like, I don't know if I've got that in me.
Yeah, it's like, so obviously, luckily enough for George, he did go on to go to the Iowa State Agricultural College
Woo!
in in 1891, but he was the first black student there. Like, you can imagine, it's great that he's been able to go there. And, well, it's not great, it's basic, exactly. But, you know, at the time, it's probably great that they allowed him to go there.
Yeah.
But you can imagine all the racism that he experienced from students who didn't think he was probably worthy,
exactly,
to attend at the time. And persevering through that in itself, like, wow.
Crazy.
Wow. His thesis was obviously in agriculture. It was plants as modified by man.
Ooh.
And yeah, very related to what he was going to go on and do as an academic in the future.
You have to see it.
And he did his master's there. He went on to work there and he was a pioneer in every stage of his life. He was the first black faculty member. Goodness. At Iowa State. But where he really went on to do some of the greatest pieces of his work was definitely at the Tuskegee Institute. And he headed the agriculture department there, as we said, and taught there for 47 years.
Goodness.
And I'm just imagining now, like, what an inspiration he must have been to the black students there. Like, what, like, pioneer at every stage and teaching you, like,
the thing is, wow. Yeah, it's like generations as well. Like, some of the first students he could have had kids who went there and still have seen him and met him for, like, it's almost like in awe. Like, because he was such a pioneer, he's probably spoken about to people in the community and even worldwide, and to actually see him in person must just be like, oh my god.
Amazing.
Like, he's actually teaching me, or he's actually in my sphere, and he made it possible for me to even be here. Like, a basic, but he made it possible, and, like, oh, so amazing.
Yeah. And then he wasn't just an inspiration for those students, he was also a savior, a hero for many of the farmers at the time.
Yeah.
So the land had been really overused by cotton farming, by, like, the nutrients had been stripped from,
yeah,
it. So basically his whole thing was improving and restoring those soils which had been depleted. So he told them that a way to do this would be, you know, systematic crop rotation.
Yeah.
So alternating the crops that were on the land, using different crops,
yeah,
say, like, sweet potatoes or legumes, things like, yeah, that, would then improve the nutrient levels and then allow other plants to be planted on there. And he also researched good crops that would grow well on this depleted soil,
yeah,
and thought about uses for them. So I think especially peanuts was, like, his main thing.
Yeah.
He had so many, like, bulletins, like, little documents,
oh,
for farmers about what they should do with the peanuts,
yeah,
and how they should grow it. And yeah, he had a huge impact for, as we said, black and white farmers alike,
yeah,
because they were just so grateful for his expertise in agriculture.
Do you know what, like, when you said that, it kind of gave me, like, he had so much power. It's like, so
power.
A lot of slaves obviously would pick cotton in these fields, and, like, for him to give, especially the black farmers that would have these lands or manage these lands, at least were able to kind of regain power over the land, like, what they were once forced to do, they could decide and make money from it now, you know, like, he gave them that ability to do so.
Yeah, definitely empowering.
Very empowering.
That's literally the word. And yeah, imagine having to work with these lands where, you know, all these horrors were taking place as well.
Exactly.
Like, the trauma almost. Obviously, he was a baby when slavery was abolished, but knowing that your parents, your grandparents, everything,
yeah,
interesting, and it's really commendable that he went through all of that as well.
Exactly. And, like, on the note of his influence, I found this point really interesting when I read it, because he was in the department for 47 years, he was known for being really dedicated, passionate, humble, all of what you want in a teacher that will really inspire you, right?
Yeah,
and
for sure.
One interesting fact is that he turned down $100,000 a year to work with Thomas Edison.
Like, the Thomas Edison?
The Thomas Edison. He turned it down. He could have got 100K a year. And do you know what he was earning at the Tuskegee Institute?
Mm-mm.
He was earning $125 a month for the full 47 years. Like, he didn't want anything more. From the first day he stepped to the day he passed away, that's what he was earning. And he didn't want any more. And that just speaks volumes, because there's a lot of people who come from poor situations. Not everybody, obviously, but like the ability to work your way up the chain and gain monetary security and power is an important thing. And for him, it was like the education and the power that education brings was way more important than any money could bring him. And I found that so like just the respect I have for him, because not everybody would have done that.
It really reminds me of sort of like, so once someone asked me, why do you think there's no black people in the department? Like, why are there no students of color around? Like, why are there so few? And I thought, and I think I answered something like, well, obviously, there's many, many reasons, but I think one aspect that applies to this is the idea that if we think about like demographics, right, like a lot of people of color are from in the UK anyway, just generally because of like when generations have arrived here, or from like working class backgrounds. And if you think about science, right, the pay is so unrewarding, I think. And I think there's a lot of desire for from people from all classes, all groups, but particularly those who might have had parents that moved here and things like that, the desire to be stable financially. Everyone wants to be stable financially, right? But then when you see jobs that are offering that, or when you see programs, like you think about internships today, which one's going to be paid? Is it going to be the science one, or is it going to be the Clifford Chance
Exactly,
this? You know what I mean?
exactly.
So I think people are often drawn to those kind of business, law, computer even kind of things at a very young age. Like maybe not a univer like the programs in school, which are promising, well, this is the salary for this and this salary for this. And obviously that's not going to deter everyone from science, but I do think it possibly is a factor in the underrepresentation at like undergrad level, maybe, because it's not attractive in terms of its pay, and especially if you're looking to support or give back to your family and stuff like that, which is it's going to be more likely if your parents have recently moved here, if your grandparents have moved here, whatever.
Exactly.
It's not desirable in a way, and I don't know if that's true or not, and I don't know if that's like actually a correlation, but I think it probably does play a role. I don't know what you think.
I can only say it's true for me, because in an ideal world, if academia paid well enough, I would most probably consider it. But personally, ensuring my current and future family stability, I need something that pays well and pays well consistently. Purely because I'm not the wealthiest. I am wealthy in not the sense of money. I'm wealthy in so many other ways, but monetarily, I'm not the most wealthiest, and that is okay. But I just want more for myself and my family, and unfortunately, academia just doesn't allow me to do that. And like, I would love to be an academic that inspires other young black psychologists, for example, to go on and continue. But right now, at the present time, I don't think that's going to be me. And it's sad to say that out loud, because I don't think I really say it out loud very often. But money really does play a role, and academia really, unless you're one of the big guys, which people take years to get where they are.
Years, ages, and you're not even secure if you're going to be a big guy, you know what I
Exactly.
mean?
Like, it's not, it's for me, I don't know if it's worth the risk. Like, I would rather invest my, like, when I do have money, invest that elsewhere in another way of trying to uplift people like me and who come from situations like mine, rather than have the possibility of being able to do that in what, 15 years, you know?
Yeah, and it's also the way that the process is so concealed, it's so hidden about how to do it. I think that's definitely, we're going a bit off the point, but I think it's still important. Like, it's concealed monetarily. Like, there's so many like little funds and little awards that you can apply to, but it's so unclear about how to get it. Like, literally, I'm trying to look at like master stuff at the moment, and I've been asking around, and yeah, every time someone says to me, it's really unclear like how to get master's funding, like clear route, but funding, applying, so secretive.
The thing is, you would think like institutions that have so much intelligence in them would understand how diversity would push your institution further. Like, having the same people over and over again will only yield you the same results. Like, tell me if I'm wrong, but like, having a variety of people will only make your work stronger.
I think so.
I just feel like people shouldn't have to worry about going into education and have to worry about, okay, I have to pay 10K for a master's and who knows how much for a PhD. Even like,
You get literally accepted into it, and then you get told whether you get the funding or not. Like, it's a joke.
how is that fair? Like,
It's not fair.
oh.
Let's go in full circle. That's why we're gassed that George has been so dedicated to academia in his way. The challenges he had to face to get there, the opportunities to earn more money in a different, slightly different field to what he wanted to work in, but yet being strong because he knew his work was having such a widespread impact is just wow. Like, it's so inspiring and
So
impressive.
inspiring.
But then we don't even mention him in history lessons. We don't even talk about him at all. Like, what
Like,
doesn't make any
the thing is,
sense?
maybe in America they speak about him more, right? Maybe. I don't
Maybe.
know. But in the British curriculum, I couldn't give you a single person that they mention at all.
Why do you think they don't like to talk about them in school and things like that?
I just feel like, because one, a lot of schools are already underfunded anyway, right? And like, if, okay, I'm not going to talk about like year seven, year eight and stuff, right? I'm gonna, let's talk about like GCSE A level, right? Where you have exams. There is not enough time and space to go off for the risk of an examiner not knowing the person or not knowing it enough to credit it, I think. Although, according to certain government bodies, they believe that there is enough space from. So basically, you know the whole petition about changing the British curriculum? The response was basically saying, no, we've made the curriculum wide enough to allow for these things to be mentioned, and it's basically kind of like the teacher's choice in a way, right? No, because
Resources, right?
like teachers are already, like, especially the teachers where, like, from the school I came from, are already being stretched to their limit just to provide the, like, enough, right?
Hundred
Let
percent,
alone having to
yeah.
now do the extra research. They're already staying back till six and working on the train home and working at home. Like, teachers deserve the respect, like the respect for all the work that they do. And I feel like it's not fair on, okay, if they wanted to do it, they should do it. If not, it's not our problem. No, but you've made so many other things compulsory within the curriculum. Why won't you make understanding the realities of slavery and Britain compulsory? Do you get what I mean?
Yeah, and also, I bet, like, obviously, I don't know this for sure, but I bet there's so many more resources, textbooks, like little interactive videos on their website about certain areas and not others. And then, of course, the teacher will be inclined to teach the class, the module with the load of resources because it's obviously more straightforward and it'll get their kids better marks. So you can't say it's their fault.
And it keeps the kids engaged. If you have a wide variety of sources, okay, you have printouts, you have a video, you have audio clips, you have YouTube video, like you have so many things. That's going to be more engaging rather than, oh, I could only make this document. Like, why should they have to go the extra mile, you know?
It's like, for some reason, like, I was reading some things and someone put it really nicely. Like, it's when we look at the scientific history and everything, especially in this country, it's always looked at through like the European mind, European lens. Like, we've seen the other episodes, like, the knowledge that is taking precedent over another just by nature of biases and also the prejudices that were there when these scientists were doing their work. Who is going to get written down? Who's going to be in the newspapers? Because, like, history works by reading through. There's gonna be some historians telling me this is not how history works, but looking through the kind of sources of the time and what was the culture. And obviously you can infer, you're not going to believe every newspaper that you've looked at in the past because that would obviously be biased. But, like, building up a picture when there's lack of information, when it's literally not, the story's not being told at the time because the prejudice is less today, the prejudice of the time is going to impact how much we know about them. because it might not have been given as much detail.
Exactly.
So the nature of it is that we have less information on those people, and therefore you can't say it's the teacher who's looking after 100 kids who should be going and searching for these things themselves. You should be providing the sufficient resources that they can give a decent lesson based on, it's your job to create the curriculum.
Exactly.
It's your job.
Exactly. So that's George Dunn. What an influential and just so important figure in history that we need to remember. And I'm so happy we discussed him today.
I'm so happy we discussed him.
So the next person we're going to talk about is a psychologist. So this is where I thrive.
Psychology.
Boo. And psychology is typically seen away from, when you look at studying psychology in lecture theatres, it's definitely white male dominated. But when you look at lecture theatres, you definitely see white female or female in general. And that's a whole nother discussion about
Really?
the disparity between, okay, the academics and the people who are actually studying the course. Why is there such a large separation? But the man I'm going to be discussing today is called Francis Cecil Sumner, and he is also referred to as the father of black psychology. And I love that, particularly because there are so many other white men have just been given the name of the father of psychology. And you know what? Yes, give me a father of black psychology. I love to see it.
I love it.
For those who don't know, black psychology is an emerging discipline that kind of focuses on the study and the behavior of people from African descent. And I find that brilliant. Like, yes, there needs to be more research done on people in non-Western countries, purely because every single human being is different in their own way, and psychology is meant to be able to both study that and then break it apart and then bring it back together. But you know, I'm happy that
Yeah.
he's referred to as the father of black psychology.
Because we said it with like the medicine stuff as well. Like you can't cure black people by using white people's
Exactly.
standards and like testing on them, because it
Exactly.
just doesn't work. And why should the mind be an exception to that?
And the thing is, it's there's so many, especially like cultural elements that just affect our day to day and how we think, how we navigate, how we, for example, suppress our emotions and when we suppress our emotions, that need to be studied. But let me not go on a psychology tangent because we can be here all day.
You can make your own podcast
I mean, if the
on
people want
that.
it.
That's
So just like George Washington Carver, he was a pioneer in his own right, and he was the first African American to receive a PhD in psychology.
Wow.
And
When was that, by the way?
he got it on June 14th, 1920.
That's older than I thought.
Yeah.
Oh, psychology apparently came around in 1879. Like, obviously not psychology, but
The
like,
psychology we know today.
it says there was an Institute for Experimental Psychology opened. That was the first.
Wundt. Is his name Wundt? Yeah,
Yes.
him, yeah.
So yeah, 1879 was psychology. Like, you've got to just think of these times, girls, because obviously some other sciences, like natural sciences stuff, like
Exactly.
been longer. So yeah, just some time scaling for you
Yes.
guys.
Thank you for that, Ella. And Sumner and two other people were known for for establishing the psychology department at Howard University, which is a HBCU, which means historically black colleges and university. And he went on to train future African American psychologists. And quick side note, he trained Kenneth Clark, who was a social psychologist and was one of the main reasons as to why, like, he was so influential in the civil rights movement and ending segregation in America with this Dole study that he conducted. I'll leave a link to a page where you can read up more about him, but
Nice.
he, again, like the influence he had on other people, magnificent. And Sumner's work, a lot of it was focused on counteracting racism and bias in psychological studies of African Americans, because prior to this, and even during his time of working, a lot of studies would just use stereotypes and those stereotypes will come up as biases, which will obviously affect the way these other psychologists and scientists are reading their results. And he tried to do a lot to tackle that and aid that. In this episode, we've spoken a lot about how a lot of people's setbacks have really given them an extra boost to where they've become today. And when we look at Sumner's background, we can see that, for example, he wasn't receiving the best education purely because he was a black boy in school. But his parents valued education so highly that with the resources that they had, they tried to provide him with as many books and stimuluses to ensure that he was continuously learning, even if the school wasn't giving them that. And personally, I can relate to that so much because my parents did so much. Why do I sound like I'm about to cry? My parents did so much to ensure that I had the best education that I could receive, and always tried to push me further, encourage me to look beyond what like school is telling me, and made me the inquisitive person that I am today. And I feel like for those who are lucky enough to have that, it's so important, because I understand not everybody gets that, and that's why I am so grateful. That's why I said before, I am wealthy in so many ways. I might have not gone to a private school, but I feel like I was pushed to constantly learn and question things within my life, and I feel like that particular part resonated with me personally. I don't know if that's the same for you, Ella.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. It's like, it's definitely a lucky thing to have parents that are on it with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
As much as you don't realise it at the time. But I think it also brings on to a point as why it's so important for schools to provide privileges such as free books and things like that to kids that might not have had that kind of parents that necessarily push them in the same way as others. Because school is a place where, well, hopefully it can be a place where it can be kind of equalizer of what's going on, you know what I mean? Because not everyone has the same home background. Not everyone's parents have the time or the commitment to spend in educating outside school. And therefore, when there's positive discrimination schemes or whatever, when there's like certain funds for children, it's not necessarily productive to kind of question why it's going on and to uphold it as a great debate.
Exactly.
Why should this scheme exist? Because you don't know what's going on. And at the end of the day, we should be supporting anyone in the way that we can.
Exactly.
You know? It just makes me so sad when people start questioning those kind of things, because are you so ignorant to the inequalities that occur like outside school that you think everyone should have exactly the same when you come to school?
But like,
no.
How can you
listen?
That equalizer's not even there. Like, I just had a flashback to being young. I can remember like book fairs that we used to have, and like, I never really had the money to buy books. I would go and I would browse and be like, I wish I could have this, wish I could have this, wish I could have, and then leave. But like, some of my other friends would have cash dollars or pounds, and it's like, even it's like little things that stick with you as a child, you know, like,
definitely.
I feel like there's so many people who are just so out of touch with the reality of some people, and they're not even willing to listen. Like, there's a reason why there's so many of these schemes trying to help kids try and even be equal with some others, like, you know, like, people need to stop like being so ready to debate it and just listen.
For sure. And it's just, they're so adamant on statistics.
Yeah.
And this is where it kind of comes down to the whole like pun of this show, I guess, like on integrity, right? That science is so caught up in numbers and correlations and significance and p-values.
Exactly.
That's traumatizing. It's so caught up in that, that people think that we can also apply those integrity principles to the presentation of science.
Exactly.
As its history and as its today, as its community today. And you can't apply those kind of principles. You can't always be like, if you earn under this amount, do this. Obviously, that's a good indication.
Yes.
But you can't necessarily say, like, you can't always debate people's experiences and put it on a scale. Sometimes you've got to listen to what people are saying and respect their opinions. And where, what I'm trying to infer really here is like, when people talk about like racism that they've experienced, you can't always say we need 10 cases to make it significant.
Exactly.
Or or we need this percentage to get into our university to make us an inclusive place. Sometimes you've got to listen to experiences.
Exactly.
And because life is not objective, mm-hmm. like I guess science is. It's subjective. It's people's experiences. It's people's biases.
Exactly.
And you can't always say, oh, because there's no slavery, then racism doesn't exist anymore. Because there's black people in Cambridge, racism doesn't exist anymore. Listen to what people are saying, because you have to be have to have integrity in what people say and trust that.
Exactly.
Rather than saying you want a figure or a number or an amount that you'll trust. Yes, in science, in its conclusions, that works. But outside of it, when we talk about its history, that is not integrity in that kind of way.
Exactly. Ella, you are speaking my language. Like, that that is the peak of it, because what makes us human and what makes us real and not figures is our experiences. And I feel like, particularly in psychology, right, it's like there's such a split people. Between
bully you guys.
Like, there's such a split between like social psychology and understanding, like almost closer to sociology than it is to what modern day psychology is, and like understanding the fundamentals of the brain and how that links to the mind, right? But I feel like I love it when the two combine, because that is the reality. That is what makes us human. That is what brings us the complications. That is what reality is. Like, racism isn't a figure. It is an experience that you have to, you can, to understand the figure, you need to understand the experience, or else the figure's, in my opinion, wrong. Do you get what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, for psychology, people are the fundamental for me, and understanding them, how they work, and how other people now influence people. That is the experience that we should be looking into. That is what makes and brings science alive. And I feel like other disciplines kind of need to add that, okay, understanding cultural elements to this, or like medicine, okay, why is it that black males are more likely to have prostate cancer, or like, why is it that,
or COVID, right, when people are talking about like black and minority ethnic thing, whatever, when those people are higher risk of COVID, yeah. It's like, not gonna lie, like at the time people, they weren't like saying to me, oh, you shouldn't go out, but like they were like, I don't know, I remember just comments like, oh, like, oh yeah, about the BAME, like the risk of COVID being higher, yeah. Like that's why I'm not so sure about like the Black Lives Matter process, because isn't the risk for those type of people higher anyway? And I was and I'm like,
no, the thing is, it's not, it's, but that's like the whole thing is that, like, to understand the statistic, you have to understand the meaning behind it. Like, it was because people from the BAME background were more likely to be in
working hospitals.
Exactly, or work on the front line, like jobs like supermarkets and stuff like that, which made,
or bus driver,
exactly,
yeah.
That made them more exposed to the virus. That's
what I thought.
That's what it is, though. It's not a biological thing.
Good.
It's,
yeah, it isn't, is it? Yeah,
it's
no.
Not.
People were trying to confuse me. Yeah.
Like, most things probably aren't. Like, obviously, there's a couple things that are, but majority are not. It's just because of the social circumstances.
Also, we definitely wouldn't have known, like, it's such a short amount of time that COVID's been around to actually make any biological links, really.
Exactly.
So, that isn't really a conclusion.
The work of Francis is just, I just wanted to just bring to light, like, because he was so influential to so many subsequent black psychologists, one of the things that he used to do with his students was that he created an award to encourage them and to showcase his excellence of his students. So that extra motivation to push them forward. And he would get them to like submit essays. So obviously it was at Howard University, so all of his students were obviously black. And it just provided an environment to, one, allow black people to pursue psychology, and two, just praise them. One of his students, Kenneth Bancroft Clark, another really prominent figure, he was one of the ones who won this award that he used to do. And he then went on to become the first black president of the APA, which is the American Psychological Association, which is the equivalent of the BPS, the British Psychological Society here.
Okay.
And again, these societies were like typically white males, and for him to become the first black president and to learn from Francis Cecil Sumner. It's just like,
It was really
exactly,
important.
he was the man who allowed for other people to follow him. And I just wanted to give him that little extra recognition because I didn't know about him. But I'm so glad that I do, and I have this platform to kind of tell other people about him.
Yeah, that was really interesting. Thank you for bringing him
You're
up.
welcome, baby.
I've got another person
Ooh.
who wasn't talked about. I find this one pretty cool because it's, well, not cool, but like it's an example of where someone's gone through struggle, but then even when they've achieved, then their work has then been taken by someone
Oh
else,
no.
and then they've not been recognised even when it's realised that this
Oh
has gone on.
no.
But then they do get recognised in the end. So it's talking about Alice Ball.
Huh.
She was born into Seattle, 1892, two bachelor's degrees, so pharmaceutical chemistry, pharmacy,
Goodness.
really successful
Exactly.
basically. And she moved back to Hawaii to do like her further research, and she
Ooh.
was actually reached out to because of her like recognition that she'd done so well to help in a hospital
We love to see
on the
it.
diagnosis and treatment of leprosy.
Wow.
In Hawaii at the time, leprosy was just basically a death sentence. So, like as soon as you got sick, you were encouraged to like draft a will and everything because there was literally no idea what the cure was at all. And they'd send people off to live on like a really, like the peninsula basically, like right at the edge, just to because they didn't want to have them in society basically because they didn't know what to do. So, the only kind of promising thing at the time was something called shilmugra oil, I think. And so they did kind of try to do oral consumption of it, but it was kind of effective, but it was just basically so unpalatable, like
Oh,
disgusting, that
goodness.
there wasn't any way they were going to keep it down. So they needed a more effective treatment, basically. So she needed to basically make it more soluble so it could be absorbed by the body. And the common way to get fats into the bloodstream is to convert them into salts. But with this type of oil, you couldn't actually do that because large salt crystals would form.
Oh.
And this would damage the blood cells. Like, it would be too large to just be soluble, if you know what I mean. But she came across a really good solution, which was using alcohol. So when mixed with alcohol, the fatty acids in this oil would actually transform into ethyl esters.
Ooh.
This is giving me kind of flashbacks to chemistry in first
Oh,
year,
goodness.
which was not bad, okay? It wasn't bad. It was really interesting, but it was very different from my other subjects, and I just found it a lot, okay? I don't know why I'm justifying saying that chemistry was not the one, but it wasn't the one. It just wasn't the one. So she had this solution, which was using alcohol and ethyl esters. They're water soluble, small
Ooh.
enough so they won't destroy the body's cells.
Love that.
And literally almost overnight, the cases started to go down.
What?
Within 2 months, half of the sick were said to be
Oh my
cured.
goodness.
So she had revolutionized the how leprosy was dealt with. But unfortunately, really shortly after her discovery, she died of a mystery illness, apparently. Suspected kind of chlorine poisoning,
Oh no.
because that kind of stuff happens. Safety measures and things like that at the time, it's hard. But because of her early death, she wasn't actually able to publish her findings. And so she was working at the University of Hawaii, and the president of the University of Hawaii, who was actually a chemist himself, Arthur Dean, just published her work without crediting her
What the hell?
and called the treatment the Dean method of solving leprosy.
Do you know what is crazy, right?
What's crazy?
As you were speaking, I was like, this story's kind of sounding a little bit familiar. And I realized I'd watched a Twitter video about leprosy in Hawaii and like
Oh my gosh,
the
seriously?
crazy things that went on because they would ostracize people's like basically leave them to die because they didn't want them
They didn't know what to do,
exactly. And they mentioned this method. They didn't mention anything about her. And I just find that a little bit weird. I don't know. I th maybe
That
it's
is
because
weird.
like they were focusing more about the treatment of the people rather than, the curable method.
Yeah, so like even her herself, like so 3 years later or something like that, the supervisor at the time, her supervisor did speak out about it and made it clear that the extraction method was actually hers rather than this guy's.
Good.
But even though this happened, the University of Hawaii, because obviously he was the president,
Yeah.
right? They didn't acknowledge it was her work for like 90 years
What?
after her death. And it was only really when I think there were people went across research of like the archives of the
Yeah.
University of Hawaii in Manoa. It was only when that happened that they were like, wait, something's happened here. But luckily, yeah,
What?
things have kind of got, yeah, I can't believe,
90
like, that's,
years.
yeah, it's
What?
not her work. But they do now, they've got like a plaque for
Yeah,
her.
because
They got caught and they've got an Alice Ball Day. But I just think, like, you know what this really reminds me of? Like the kind of Rosalind Franklin story.
Yeah.
And like, obviously, different fields, DNA, probably, yeah, much, I don't know, different kind of levels of the research going on. But Rosalind Franklin, like, today, we all talk about it and we all like got books, and then well, we actually don't all talk about it. Like, there's levels to
Yeah.
talking about what's going on. Rosalind Franklin is significantly higher than kind of what Alice Ball got,
Yeah.
because it's like she was literally 2000 is when Alice Ball started getting her recognition. But still, like, a lot of times today, like, there's the textbooks don't recognize Franklin,
Exactly.
but yeah, it's kind of similar story to that.
I just, for me, it's like, particularly with Ball, it's like, okay, but you put a plaque and like you acknowledge that you did something wrong. But the fact that it was allowed to go on for 90 years, and like I dread to think that if people hadn't looked at the archives, how long they would have carried on in doing that. Because it's like not the typical story. Like someone did fight for her corner when she wasn't able to do so herself. But like again, it's just like larger institutions just saying, no, this is what we want. I hope that one day she will get full recognition, like everybody will know her name and like people will study her and see the great work that she has done. Like I can't imagine coming up with a cure for something. Like
Yeah.
my brain doesn't work like that, but I respect it so much and like the lives that she impacted.
Oh, definitely. It something like 8,000 people that were diagnosed with leprosy, like, were benefited from
Oh my
her research.
God.
They were no longer exiled, instead being able to be treated like in their own homes and things. And yeah, and today, like, I think in 2016, like, she was recognized in Hawaii as like one of the most influential women in their history.
Okay.
Which is good, but I just think about if she had been given the recognition at the time, how many other other people which don't have their heroes
Yeah.
in the history books, if she'd been recognized at the time, how many people missed out on having that as a hero for
Honestly.
chemistry or pharmacy or something? Because yeah, we can look up to her as a hero now, but so many other young people who were pursuing science then would have greatly benefited from knowing that she's, been so influential in
Exactly.
chemistry, in medicine in this way. So yeah, it pains me that it took so long, because even though we can recognize the great that's going on today, so many people lost out on having her as a hero.
Yeah, so many. But yeah, I think that's all that we've got for today. And obviously, there's so many other people that we haven't spoken about. And what we want you to do is just take a look out there, see who's out there, see who has inspired but doesn't have the recognition. Take that extra step and look and research about other people who deserve to be recognized. We hope you've enjoyed speaking about George Washington Carver, speaking about Francis Cecil Sumner, speaking about Alice Ball and all of their histories and their realities. And I hope that has inspired you.
Yeah, it's good. And so we've talked about historic figures which were never really given the recognition at the time, or aren't given recognition in our history books, and talked about why that happens.
Yeah.
Next episode will be kind of more about students today and moving up the career ladder as a young person who doesn't have those heroes there.
Yeah.
What is it actually like as students today, and what can we do to help students today?
Exactly.
Because we can talk about heroes and put them in our books and in our newsletters and our magazines and on Twitter, but what is the experience as a young ethnic minority in the science field?
Exactly.
So thanks for listening here on CAM FM, and we hope to see you next week here on CAM FM.
Have a good week, everybody.
See you later, guys.
Bye.